Welcome to Leading Tone. I'm your host, Jim Ware. To celebrate the upcoming 21st anniversary Fellowship of the Ring in concert performance at Radio City Music Hall in New York this February, I'm going to be talking about Howard Shore's score for Peter Jackson's 2001 film, The Fellowship of the Ring, the first part of his immense Lord of the Rings trilogy. Director of The Frighteners, Bad Taste, Meet the Feebles, and Brain Dead, Peter Jackson was not the name anyone expected to be attached to a hugely expensive three-film adaptation of J.R.R. Tolkien's beloved books. Similarly, composer Howard Shore, perhaps best known for his collaborations with body horror master David Cronenberg, was an unexpected assignment for a project of this scale. Long before production of the films got underway, Peter Jackson tasked his partner Fran Walsh with assembling temp music for their initial pitch videos and animatics. Much of that music was by Howard Shore. During production of the films, online rumours persisted of various composer assignments, including James Horner, Danny Elfman, Wojciech Kilar, and others, but Walsh insists that Shore was their first and only choice. Shore's attachment to The Lord of the Rings was confirmed in August 2000, but his journey with the filmmakers began much earlier. The composer travelled to New Zealand in summer 1999 to see the huge pre-production effort underway and to meet key personnel, including Alan Lee, Richard Taylor, Philippa Boyens, and of course Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh. Shore immersed himself in Tolkien's writing and broader Ring mythology, and began sketching themes in October 1999, beginning with material for The Shire, Frodo, and The Fellowship, despite not having seen a frame of film. He visited New Zealand several more times during production, visiting the sets, viewing rough cuts, and developing musical ideas. Shore was no stranger to literary adaptations. Total immersion into the work was also his approach for David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch and Crash, allowing him the freedom to experiment, conceptualizing and writing musical ideas attached to the world of the literary source, but not tied to the strict timings of the film adaptation. Naked Lunch and Crash are both uniquely eclectic, the former featuring the semi-improvised jazz stylings of Ornette Coleman, and the latter primarily written for electric guitar, harp, and a battery of metallic percussion. This type of thing is not unusual in Shore's output, but nor is writing for large symphony orchestra. Shore's first score to utilize a full orchestra was David Cronenberg's The Fly in 1986, sparsely spotted, with moments of tremendous beauty, sweeping grandeur, and genuine horror, it remains a highlight of Shore's career. It started his collaboration with the London Philharmonic Orchestra and was adapted into an opera in 2008, but that's a story for another time. Okay. Shaw's dark operatic writing for Al Pacino's 1996 drama documentary Looking for Richard uses orchestra and chorus to full effect and is a very close relative to his later work for The Lord of the Rings. This grand operatic style was the direction Shaw decided to take for The Lord of the Rings. The score calls for tremendous forces: a 100-piece symphony orchestra, 60-voice mixed chorus, 30-voice boys choir, and a selection of vocal and instrumental soloists, some of which wouldn't sound out of place in a David Cronenberg score. Shaw and the filmmakers wanted to create a sound world that seemed ancient yet familiar. Music that could sound like it existed within Tolkien's Middle-earth, but still function as a film score, both from the world and about the world. A challenge for any composer, but in this case on an unprecedented scope and scale. In the composer's words, "The Lord of the Rings is the most complex fantasy world ever created, so I'm holding a mirror up to it and trying to create something that's the image of it." Tolkien uses songs, poems, and various texts throughout the novels, and although they're not incorporated in the film extensively, the filmmakers wanted to evoke the spirit of them in the score. Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens wrote and adapted several texts for Shaw to use in the score, with Tolkien scholar David Salo translating into various Tolkien languages. The use of Tolkien's texts in this way adds another layer of complexity to the musical texture. The final score uses six languages: Sindarin, Quenya, Black Speech, Adonaic, Kuzdal, and a small amount of English. As if that wasn't enough of a challenge, Shaw also took on the responsibilities of orchestrating all his own material by hand, which is very unusual for any film score, especially one of this scale. Ever the methodical traditionalist, Shaw sketched the entire score in pencil and orchestrated in pen, a practice he continues to this day. Shaw journeyed to New Zealand once again in early 2001 to prepare a preview for the Cannes Film Festival. In an unusual and expensive move, New Line Cinema decided to screen 26 minutes of footage from the trilogy, the first completed footage screened anywhere, including a significant part of the Mines of Moria sequence. Shaw began writing this composition in February, utilising all the thematic material sketched up to that point. In April, the forces of the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, augmented with a 60-voice Samoan Maori choir, were gathering in Wellington Town Hall for the first 4 days of recording for the Fellowship of the Ring. As an aside, Shaw refers to the pieces of music in the film as compositions. The usual word for describing a piece of music in a film score, cue, is never used. Shaw's compositions are often very long, in the case of Moria, over 20 minutes. Although ostensibly intended as temp music to be replaced during later recording sessions, the composer and filmmakers were so pleased with the performance of the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra that it was retained in the final mix. May the 11th, 2001, the preview footage was screened for the press to rave reviews, and the fervent buzz for the film continued to build. While the press and fans could breathe a sigh of relief at this point, there was no time to spare for the filmmakers and composer. Post-production was underway, Peter Jackson was still shooting, and Shaw still had 2.5 hours of music to write for a film that was at this point well over 3 hours in length. Recording sessions for the remainder of the score took place in August and September 2001, with additional recording that November, in London. Shaw utilised the London Philharmonic Orchestra, his London orchestra of choice since The Fly in 1986, bolstered with the London Voices, the London Oratory School Schola, and vocal soloists including Miriam Stockley, Elizabeth Fraser, Edward Ross, and Enya. In addition to the standard orchestra, Shaw's score also called for solo instruments, including reeta, a North African double reed instrument with a piercing, nasal and occasionally unpleasant tone, musette, guitar, mandolin and whistle, forming what was colloquially known as the Hobbit Band, monochord, used in Lothlorien, taiko drums, suspended gongs, and distressed piano for Isengard. For those curious as to how to distress a piano, put on some gardening gloves, wrap a medium gauge chain around them, and strike the lower strings. Shaw also employed his manifesto, most recently refined in his score for Tarsem Singh's The Cell. This is a system for notating and performing aleatoric music, or music with a degree of unpredictability. Although not employed much in Fellowship, it's used extensively in The Two Towers. Performers are given a set of notes and can choose to perform them in several different ways, resulting in unique and unpredictable textures. Recording sessions primarily took place at Watford Town Hall just north of London, with an attention to detail bordering on the obsessive. The average orchestral film score may take 5 or 6 sessions to record, but The Fellowship of the Ring required more than 50, with the total number of recorded takes running well into the thousands. Orchestra, choir and soloists were recorded separately, then expertly mixed at Abbey Road Studios. Shaw wrote, orchestrated and recorded almost 3 hours of music, a huge amount by any standard. Shaw's score takes the listener on a journey through the many different cultures and landscapes of Middle-earth. The score is heavily leitmotivic, with many of the motifs speaking to cultures, groups, and objects rather than individual characters, in keeping with the grand sweep of Tolkien's writing. In the first film alone, we are introduced to hobbits, dwarves, men, 2 races of elves, and the forces of evil in Mordor, each with their own musical devices and signatures tied together by the symphony orchestra and chorus. I should stress that this is a short primer. I can't possibly cover everything in the time I have, but here is a whistle-stop tour of Howard Shaw's The Fellowship of the Ring. I'll return to the prologue later. It's incredibly dense and introduces much of the core thematic material. At the tail end of the prologue, we're introduced to the Hobbits of the Shire for the first time. The material for the Hobbits is simple and flexible, allowing Shaw to create several variations throughout the score. The Hobbit Band, including solo fiddle, mandolin, musette and whistle, accompanies the orchestra as we are first introduced to Hobbiton. This is the pensive setting of the Shire theme, representing the introspective nature of hobbits and their longing for home. A little later, we'll hear the rural setting, which is more closely tied to the environment of the Shire. Unlike the pensive setting, this is so closely tied to the Shire that that it won't be heard again until we return to the Shire at the end of the Return of the King. A little later, Shaw introduces what will become the hymn setting, stripping the theme back to a broad reading of its harmonic material, evoking the theme without explicitly stating it, and often used in more emotional moments. The Shire theme is also developed into a Hobbit's understanding, also used in more tender and intimate settings. All the Shire material combines for the song In Dreams, featured in the end credits and performed by Edward Ross. The song evokes a sense of longing and nostalgia for home. Despite travelling further and further away from the Shire, its thematic material continues to develop throughout the trilogy, becoming increasingly dark and beleaguered as the Hobbit's journey continues. As Gandalf races to Minas Tirith, and again as Frodo and Sam leave the Shire, we hear the first seeds of the Fellowship theme. As the Fellowship forms, this motif grows in strength and prominence, emerging as a glorious fanfare as the Fellowship is finally formed at the Council of Elrond. The theme accompanies the journey of the Fellowship across the Misty Mountains and out of Rivendell, but becomes increasingly desperate as the company is pursued by orcs and darker forces through the mines of Moria. Fellowship theme is pivotal to the score, hinted at in the prologue and closely related to many other themes. Like the history of the ring, it's part of the linkage that ties the score together. Imladris, or Rivendell, is the first elvish culture encountered in the Fellowship of the Ring. Unlike the elves of Lothlorien encountered later, those of Rivendell are more open to outsiders. The arpeggiating music shimmers with the accompaniment of harp and chimes, giving a sense of awe and wonder. An ethereal female choir sings the Sindarin text, Hymn to Elbereth. Also tied to Rivendell is Enya's first contribution to the score, Aneron, a love theme for Aragorn and Arwen. This composition was written and performed by Enya, but to ensure a seamless fit with the rest of the score, Shaw orchestrated the material and recorded with the London Philharmonic. Enya also wrote and performed the song May It Be for the end credits, again orchestrated by Shaw and performed by the London Philharmonic. In addition to the love theme by Enya, the character of Arwen is also given a delicate theme for her first reveal. Thank you. As the trilogy progresses, her complex relationship with Aragorn will generate a wealth of thematic material. The remnants of Moria are the only dwarvish civilization we see in The Lord of the Rings, and only an echo of their former self. Shaw's music for Moria takes on a dark, ancient quality, utilizing a 60-voice Samoan Maori chorus singing in the dwarvish language of Kuzdal, as if from the depths of the earth. Shaw takes the opportunity to develop the music for one culture in a self-contained, extended 20-minute composition. The Fellowship travel through the dank tunnels before encountering the ancient underground dwarvish city of Dwarrodelph. Shaw's theme hints at the former glory and grandeur of this decaying place. As the Fellowship journeys through Moria, they awaken evil forces including goblins and much, much worse. The guttural Kuzdal choir forms the rhythmic centre of their desperate attempt to escape the Long Dark. After, spoiler alert, Gandalf's fall in Moria, we never hear the Fellowship theme in as bright a form again, but it will return later in different forms throughout the trilogy. The Fellowship flees Moria, entering the woods of Lothlorien, and Shaw introduces the second Elvish culture. Whereas Rivendell felt warm and comforting, Lothlorien is quite the opposite. Cold, sinister and unsettling. The eastern-flavoured music of Lothlorien augments the orchestra with nave flute, sarangi, and the omnipresent drone of a monochord. Female chorus, accompanied by mezzo-soprano soloist, presents an ethereal and exotic texture. Cultural dualities are a recurring theme throughout the trilogy. In the first film, we see two Elvish cultures, Rivendell and Lothlorien. We've had a brief introduction to the world of men in Gondor, but we will also see Rohan in the Two Towers. Sauron, his forces of evil and the Land of Mordor have a singular purpose, to retrieve the One Ring, and all the thematic material emphasizes that connection. The Ring itself has two key themes. The first is the history of the Ring, used extensively in the prologue, and whenever the ring changes hands in its journey. The grandest statement occurs as the Fellowship passes the Gargantuan Argonath statues on the River Anduin, tying Tolkien's second and third ages together. second theme is the Seduction of the Ring, performed by Boys Chorus and used when the One Ring is attempting to assert its seductive influence and allure. A hint of Sauron's theme, also termed the Evil of the Ring, could be heard in the prologue, but it emerges with full force when we first see Minas Morgul. This material represents both Sauron and the evil influence of the One Ring across Middle-earth. The orchestra is often accompanied by the piercing nasal tones of the Reeta, a double-reeded North African instrument. The theme gets limited usage in the Fellowship of the Ring, but becomes increasingly prominent as the trilogy progresses. Sauron's servants, the Ringwraiths, have similarly forceful material, a choral outburst sung in Adunaic using the text The Revelation of the Ringwraiths. First introduced in the prologue, this material is restated with increasing force during every encounter with the Wraiths. Given that the Wraiths are hunting the One Ring, it's only appropriate that the chords of the theme are built by stacking the notes of the history of the Ring. Saruman's willful destruction of nature and industrialization of Isengard is represented by a brutal six-note figure, always set in 5-4 time. The underlying 5-4 rhythmic patterns are used, often unpitched and without melody, throughout the score to represent Saruman's influence and his Uruk-hai army. Listen out for the distressed piano discussed earlier. Saruman's lust for the One Ring does not go unnoticed. This motif is based on the same notes as the history of the Ring. The world of men does not play a huge part in the Fellowship of the Ring, but there are passages that hint at the importance that Gondor will have in the remainder of the trilogy, both centered around Boromir, son of Denethor, steward of Gondor. The first is a noble horn line, heard as he addresses the Council of Elrond. This line represents Gondor in decline, and hints at the faded grandeur of Minas Tirith and what Gondor used to be. The second is more hopeful and optimistic, and underscores Boromir's discussion with Aragorn in Lothlorien. Aragorn's material is more evasive, suggestive of his reluctance to accept his fate. A figure is first whispered when the hobbits spot him from afar in the Inn of the Prancing Pony. But is given more prominence once Aragorn begins to show his heroic capabilities on Weathertop. Once he refuses the temptation of the ring at Amon Hen, a new theme, closely related to the Fellowship theme, bursts forth. As the trilogy progresses, this material will be developed and weaved into other themes. Once the Fellowship breaks and the members diverge, so does the thematic material. Themes are broken apart and fragments hybridized, taking the score in new directions. It's impossible to view The Fellowship of the Ring as a single film score. It's the first act of a 9.5-hour piece, or even longer if you're watching the extended versions. Let's return to the beginning. The score opens with a 7.5-minute prologue, diving into the second age of Tolkien's Middle-earth. It's an overwhelming and intense sequence, heavy with exposition. The score introduces a wealth of thematic material, beginning with Lothlorien underneath Galadriel's narration. Moving on to the history of the ring. The tiniest of hints of the evil of the ring, most often associated with Sauron, before an explosion of the Ringwraith material. Then the tragic fall of men, with a skeletal hint of the Fellowship theme. The introduction of Gollum, although he doesn't have a significant part to play in the story until the Two Towers, his pity motif appears whenever this interloper's presence is felt. And finally, we transition to the Shire. It's a dense, action-packed sequence to immerse the viewer in Peter Jackson's vision of Tolkien's world. The history of the Ring ties it all together, punctuating the Ring's journey from bearer to bearer. Although the prologue is the first piece heard in the film, it was actually the very last to be recorded for the theatrical cut in November 2001. It was a tricky sequence for the filmmakers and was recut numerous times. The advantage to Shore of leaving it to the end was that he had all of his musical storytelling arcs earlier fully worked out sessions. Shore had recorded various concepts for this sequence, and some of these could be heard on the original album and the Rarities archive. Some parts are near identical, including the fight with Sauron and the latter half of the sequence with Gollum, but some are entirely different. Interestingly, the material for Gondor appears prominently. And the motif that we've come to know as the history of the Ring is nowhere to be found. Film scores are always fluid during the process of composition and recording, and The Fellowship of the Ring is no exception. The material for Gondor was originally intended to be more prominent, including a grand appearance as the Fellowship passes the Argonath. But this was ultimately replaced with the history of the Ring, perhaps to keep the focus of the film on the task of Frodo and the Ring. There's much that I haven't discussed, but sadly time is limited. Leading Tone will return to the Lord of the Rings trilogy in much more detail later in 2023. The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring in concert is being performed at Radio City Music Hall in New York on February the 6th to the 9th, 2023. With the Lviv National Philharmonic Orchestra of Ukraine, conducted by Ludwig Vicky, it promises to be a night to remember. For much more information about Howard Shore's music for The Lord of the Rings, be sure to check out the book The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films by Doug Adams, which also includes a CD of alternate, unused, and demo material from the trilogy. I'm your host, Jim Ware. Join me again soon for another episode of Leading Tone.